Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Bostic versus Weber. Mr. Steve Miller, an attorney from Sioux Falls for the appellant Bostic, and Mr. Frank Geegan, an assistant attorney general from Pierre for the appellee Douglas Weber. Justice Meyer Henry has disqualified herself in this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable David Genap, a circuit judge from the Third Judicial Circuit, to sit in her place. Mr. Miller, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you. It's nice to be back here. Thank you for inviting me. I want to start by apologizing to the court because in reading my reply brief, and I want to get this out of the way right away, in reading the reply brief, I'm making an argument in passing, which is not true. And that is that when the trial court issued its writ in response to the application for habeas relief, I argued that the trial court necessarily found that there was a colorable claim. And what I neglected to realize as I was writing the reply brief at the last minute is that the claim that we're here on now was filed later as an amended petition. And so there is no, the argument that I made doesn't carry any water. That was an honest mistake, and I was not trying to mislead anyone. I apologize to the court and to Mr. Geegan. But that having been said, this is a habeas appeal. This case was set on the court's non-oral calendar, and as I understand it, the court moved it to the oral calendar. And so what I imagine is that someone on the court has some questions for me, and I would appreciate it if you would ask them as soon as you can. I haven't been here for 10 years, at least as an advocate, and I'm kind of nervous. So
we don't bite.
I understand that. Thank you. The primary position that Mr. Bostic has today is that in a claim of ineffective trial counsel, he deserves one full and fair opportunity to litigate that claim. This court has relegated those claims to habeas corpus, and as I point out in my initial brief, that's a wise policy, because as everyone realizes, this court does not, in normal direct appeals, have a record sufficient to decide the issue of ineffective trial counsel. And so we're relegated to habeas corpus to do that. Once that is done, however, Mr. Bostic takes the position that he has a right to fairly litigate that claim. And in the first habeas hearings, I guess I won't even call them a habeas proceeding. I won't even dignify them by saying that, because I'm not sure a formal application was ever filed, at least by Mr. Bostic. In the first habeas hearings, the adversary process, which is what all of us, as attorneys anyway, are sworn to act within, just simply fell apart. And I think everybody in this courtroom realizes that an ineffective trial counsel claim on the facts of this case is an uphill battle for Mr. Bostic. I think everybody realizes that. But I don't think it can be fairly adjudicated where the evidence hasn't been presented, where the trial lawyer herself has not been asked about why she did certain things or didn't do certain things, where the witness who Mr. Bostic is claiming, the live witness who he is claiming should have been testifying at his trial, hasn't been interviewed, and that the content of that is not in the record, it's simply impossible to fairly judge an ineffective trial counsel claim under those circumstances. I don't know, since I'm in this position myself on occasion, I get habeas cases before applications are filed. I don't know what the procedure should be for an attorney, let's say in Mr. Thompson's position or in my position on a different case that I have, to conclude that filing an application itself wouldn't be the ethical thing to do. If I conclude, for example, after investigating a case, that there is no colorable claim that I can present, I don't know what action I should be taking. I do know, however, that if I take the action that Mr. Thompson took, and I take an internal attorney-client document, and I file it as habeas petition number application number one, and because I take that action, I doom my client's ability to ever complain on habeas again as to that issue, or for that matter, any other issue, without jumping through the procedural hoops that we are trying to jump through today. I do know that as an attorney, I'm not supposed to do that. That's the one thing I do know. I'm not...
There's some suggestion in the record, however, that Mr. Bostic wanted those issues, that issue statement paper. I'm not sure what you want to call it, but isn't there some suggestion that he wanted that revealed to the court?
I don't remember it, if there is.
I thought there was a suggestion that those are the issues he wanted to present.
Those are the issues. He, 3 days after his attorney, with his consent, dropped the appeal, he sent the attorney the issues letter. It's dated 3 days later. I guess in the record we don't know that it was actually 3 days later, but it's dated 3 days later, and he sent it to Mr. Thompson. It's not captioned as any court document. It's just a list of issues. Those are the ones he indicated to Mr. Thompson that he wanted to have investigated, probably that he wanted to have raised. I think that's probably a fair statement. He's an inmate, and he wanted to raise these issues.
Is your client still in the penitentiary?
Yes, he's in Springfield.
Okay, and is he still seeking to raise the same issues that he did in the original petition?
No.
All right.
No.
Is that a problem?
Not to me. I don't think it is to him either. He has asked me whether I am appealing the jury instruction claim, and I told him no. But any of the other claims that he raised pro se, and as the court's aware, there's a laundry list of them. He has not brought any of those up again. He and I sat down and talked for a while about some of them, when he asked me specifically about some of them, and I told him why, in my opinion, they didn't rise to the level of what can be raised in a habeas case, or why they were invalid. But when he and I talked, this ineffective trial counsel issue is the one that he wanted raised. And so that's why I'm here.
Let's take this from a different tact. And maybe it goes back to your initial suggestion of, ask questions in the as early as possible.
Thank you.
But had there been ineffective assistance of counsel, effective assistance of counsel?
By Mr. Thompson? By habeas counsel?
Either one of them.
Oh, okay.
All right. Had he had effective assistance of counsel, what would an effective counsel shown for basic facts that would entitle him to some relief that would, establish prejudice? Because none of this was shown. Can you tell us that?
As I understand your question, it's if I went back and had a hearing right now on my ineffective trial counsel claim, what would I have shown to show that Maggie Vandemore was ineffective, or the prejudice to it? Is that what
right.
the question is? What I can say is I would have shown what's listed in the amended application. At trial, I assume the court has a trial transcript available to it. I assume that was sent up by the clerk of court's office. But at the trial, some of the witnesses that were testifying, some of the jail witnesses, which Ms. Vandemore relied upon to try to assert the defense, referred to records that the jail had showing Mr. Bostic's medical condition. I'm not sure if the prescriptions list, the indication in the booking record that Mr. Bostic was currently taking prescriptions for those, I'm not sure if that was mentioned at trial or not, but I know that it exists. But some of those witnesses referred to these documents, and they were never presented by Ms. Vandemore. Even if you assume that before trial she didn't know of them, during trial she was alerted to them and did nothing to produce them. There's also a witness who would testify to Mr. Bostic's medical condition when she saw him on the day of the furlough. And I'm going by memory here, but these things are listed in the second amended application, the one that re-raises the ineffective trial counsel claim. The problem with, and I know the state makes the argument, which I would have made too in their position, that I didn't show prejudice under the Strickland test.
Well, wasn't there some testimony or in the record that on this furlough thing, he never did anything about his medication himself? that he never went to a doctor, he never went and got the medication he claimed to be needed, or...
I don't think that's in the trial record, because he didn't testify. The only people that testified were law enforcement witnesses, and they would have no way of knowing that. I think there may be something in closing argument. I think it was Tom Hensley. I think he commented on the absence of any testimony that...
Okay, and that may be where I'm getting it. Okay. So you're just saying there's an absence of testimony or comment in closing argument about there's no showing that he ever did anything, so there it's a phony defense?
Well, I think that's there. I guess I'm not saying it. I don't remember for sure, but I think that's there. The problem with the, even if we assume this is not prejudice per se, let's assume for, I don't agree, but let's assume for the sake of argument that I have to show prejudice under the Strickland test, that I have to show that this claim, if raised now, would have merit. The problem with that is that in light of the way the procedure of this case happened before it got to Judge Keene's decision and got up here, there was no opportunity to do that. I'm not proud of this fact, but I filed the second amended petition for habeas relief the day before the hearing on the state's motion to dismiss. They made a motion to dismiss alleging successive habeas application and failure to state a claim upon which relief could be granted based upon the jury instruction claim, which was the claim that Mr. Bostic raised pro se and that I then rephrased in an amended petition. So then we reached court a day after I filed the second amended petition on the motion to dismiss. At that point, and if you read the transcript with Judge Keene, he likes to talk about the law, and so we did, and we talked about the meaning of the Jackson decision, and there was a lengthy discussion in there about that, and there was no opportunity for me to present the merits of my case. And the problem with the argument that to prove prejudice under Strickland, I have to prove a meritorious case, is that it really does put the cart before the horse. When you've got a state motion to dismiss on procedural grounds, which alleges that I can't even raise this issue, much less try to support it with evidence, how can you then say that to defeat that motion to dismiss, I have to put on my case?
But eventually you will have to be able to prove, if we agree with you and send it back, you're still going to have to show prejudice, aren't you?
Yes, I'm going to have to show prejudice for Ms. Vandemore's alleged errors.
And won't you need medical expert testimony for that?
I don't know. I know that I'll need the medical records. I don't know that I'll need an actual doctor, but, you know, I haven't even gotten to that point yet. I'm court appointed here. I don't do the work until... because of voucher problems, I don't do the work until I have to. What I had to do was meet the motion to dismiss on procedural grounds. I went there to refute the motion to dismiss on procedural grounds. And now, if I am held, and maybe I should be, if the court thinks I should be held to a standard of having to prove my case at the motion to dismiss stage, which claims that I don't even have the right to assert my case, much less prove it, then I mean, you can rule that way, but what are you saying? You're saying that I'm ineffective for not proving my case as a precondition to being able to assert my case. And if I'm ineffective, I mean, now we've got the real merry-go-round happening.
So you're saying that absent this motion to dismiss, you were prepared to put your client on the stand and testify?
I would have been, yes.
On the prejudice issues?
Yes. I would have filed the second amended petition. We would have had a hearing on the merits on the claim of ineffective trial counsel, which at this stage of the appeal is all that I'm asking for, is a hearing on the merits of ineffective trial counsel. We all know it's an uphill battle. He may well very not win. What I said at the very end of my reply brief is particularly appropriate. He might or he might not prevail, but all we're asking for is a chance to try.
Should you have been held to put in an offer of proof? I know that it's coming at you in a tough way in a motion to dismiss. But is there any requirement for you to have put in an offer of proof as to what you were going to show that you're entitled to a hearing on the merits so you could prove prejudice?
Kind of a preliminary screening device.
I guess so.
You know, if that had been brought up, I don't see what's wrong with that. I know that the normal, of course, I'm arguing automatic prejudice because this was so bad that it's automatic prejudice.
Well, it goes to right to effective assistance of counsel, and if you don't have it, you know, if you're right, and if you don't have effective assistance of counsel, the person's obviously been prejudiced, hasn't he?
I think so. To answer the original question you asked, though, I do know that the U.S. Supreme Court has said that if I'm, now I'm just stating, I'm just answering your question by analogy. If I am attacking the ineffectiveness of my appeal attorney, direct appeal attorney, for raising issues A through C, but not raising meritorious issue D, and then let's further assume that the court doesn't address absent issue D in its appeal decision, I do know that what I have to prove by way of prejudice is that the result of the appeal would more likely than not have been different. In other words, I have to make a showing that the missing issue D would have won, which is what I understand you are saying. There should be some screening device to show that the issue in habeas that I'm claiming was inadequately raised in habeas number one. There must be some screening device somewhere to show that the underlying ineffective trial counsel issue has probable merit. And the problem in this case is that I was never asked to do that. I was never given an opportunity to summon witnesses or, you know, submit affidavits or make an offer of proof. I know that, I think in habeas, I know it was true in post-conviction, I think it's also true in habeas if this court has said that the rules of civil procedure apply, specifically summary judgment motions. You know, I do a lot of habeas work, or at least in the past I have done a lot of habeas work. And I really miss the old post-conviction statutes because they set everything out. And it was just easier to follow those than it is on a case-by-case basis for this court, and I understand you have to do this, I'm not complaining here, but on a case-by-case basis for this court to come up with procedural rules. And for me to find, for me as a practitioner, to find all those rules by looking at all of the court's habeas case law. You know, by using habeas as the preferred means to challenge the constitutionality of a conviction, we're putting ourselves, as South Dakotans, we're putting ourselves in the same position that the federal government is for 2254 habeas actions. And you've got Supreme Court justices, and unanimously you've got the Circuit Court of Appeal judges complaining about the procedural labyrinth that the federal habeas law stands in. And they've gotten themselves in that position and they can't find a way out. And I'm wondering why we have to put ourselves in that position. I mean, let's say, for example, that you impose a burden, a duty, on me to have made an offer of proof showing probable success of the Maggie Vandemore is ineffective argument. Let's say you impose that upon me. And let's say somehow we get over the burden later on, because Mr. Bostick will certainly raise this, we get over the burden later on of I was ineffective for not anticipating this problem.
Let's jump one question ahead. Why hasn't he had his day in court because Catherine Peeple did not raise the matter on the merits that you claim? In other words, she came up here and she got a decision. She didn't get oral argument, but she had his case and she did not raise that issue, right?
Sorry, I know I'm supposed to stand here. She raised it as an add-on at the end of her issue two. In issue one, she raised a substantive claim that probably should have been raised on direct appeal, but wasn't. In her issue two, she claimed ineffectiveness, as I understand it, I've got the briefs over there, she claimed ineffectiveness of Mike Thompson in his role as direct appeal attorney for not having raised issue one, which she had to do to make issue one eligible for habeas relief. And then at the end, and of course at this point, by the time she's writing these briefs to this court, she's been on this case for over a year, she realized the real problem here. With respect to the Ms. Vandemore was ineffective argument, which is there was no evidentiary development, per se, before Judge Cirska. And what she specifically asked for was the chance to have a fair hearing on that claim. And so I can only repeat to you what I said in my original briefs. I don't read her briefs as raising that as an issue. Even if you get over the problem of the Certificate of Probable Cause not including it, I don't read her briefs as raising that as a substantive issue. She was forced to concede, as she did in her reply brief, that the evidence wasn't there to justify any relief from this court. and that the state was right in complaining that the evidence wasn't there, and that that was done because of the way the matter was handled before Judge Cirska, and she finally asked for a remand so that he could have, Mr. Bostic could have his day in court. And so I don't see this court's summary affirmance as a res judicata bar to this.
Okay. Now go back to your argument that I interrupted, if you can remember.
I can't remember.
Right. Let me ask one quick question.
Thank you.
Could you have even made an honest offer of proof without having an evidentiary hearing or hiring an investigator or having an expert?
I would have had to find and interview the witness myself. I would have probably produced that by way of affidavit. I would have treated it as if it were a summary judgment motion, and I would have made some sort of showing consistent with that. I would have referred to the amended petition, which I still believe sets out a colorable claim for relief. And at this point, all we're talking about is it a colorable claim for relief? Does it justify a hearing? You know, my position here today is we should throw out, well, this court should throw out what happened in front of Judge Cirska as if it never happened before. We should treat this as if we are now raising for the first time in a first habeas an ineffective trial counsel argument, and we should proceed from that point. If the state believes, and I know Sioux Falls local practice by the state's attorney's office doesn't normally include this, I don't know why not, but if the state believes that while it is a colorable claim on paper, it's a garbage claim in reality, then what they can do is file a summary judgment motion. What they can do is depose Mr. Bostic. I don't know why they don't do these things. You know, I don't think either that every allegation of ineffective trial counsel demands a hearing before a judge. To that extent, I agree with what the state argued in their brief. Not every habeas needs an evidentiary hearing. But, you know, it's not my burden to tell the prosecutor, you know, there are procedural ways here that this can be handled more easily than having a hearing. That's not my job. If the prosecutor wants to read your old habeas cases to figure out the procedural quagmire, they can do that. If they want me to teach them, they can hire me to do that. I'd love the money. But I have to read those to figure out what my role is in habeas number two. And so I just think we ought to throw out habeas number one. Just treat it as if it never happened and give Mr. Bostic one fair opportunity to present this claim. It could be that he won't prevail on this claim. I know that trying to...
Your time has expired, counsel.
Okay, thanks.
We'll have you back for 10 minutes in a little bit.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Geegan, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. The sole issue raised on appeal is whether Bostic should be allowed to yet again proceed with his claim that defense counsel Maggie Vandemore was ineffective. Although conceding in his brief that this issue was previously argued pro se during his first habeas petition, Bostic argues that it was inadequately raised due to the alleged ineffective representation afforded by post-conviction counsel Mike Thompson. Before getting to the merits of Mr. Bostic's argument, the state would like to take just a brief moment to comment on the procedural history of this case. Mr. Bostic was convicted in 1998 of escaping from the Minnehaha County Jail. At his sentencing hearing in February of that year, defense counsel Ms. Vandemore informed the court that Bostic wanted to appeal his conviction based on her alleged ineffective assistance. While indicating that ineffective assistance to counsel typically cannot be raised until a habeas, the trial court, the Honorable Judge Myron, indicated that she would appoint someone else to look at the case. In the meantime, a notice of appeal was filed on Bostic's behalf. An order was later entered by Judge Myherney appointing Mike Thompson to represent Bostic on appeal. Thompson later filed a motion with this court asking that the appeal be dismissed. As indicated in Bostic's affidavit in support of that motion, there was only one appealable issue, that being whether the trial court abused her discretion in denying his request for substitute counsel based on an alleged conflict of interest within the public defender's office. According to Bostic's own affidavit, that request had been rendered moot after the State Bar Association had dismissed his complaint against Cynthia Howard. This court, therefore, was asked to dismiss the appeal so Bostic could pursue in a state habeas his claim of ineffective assistance against Ms. Vandemore. Bostic was later asked by Mr. Thompson to provide him with a list of issues he wished to present. After discussing those issues with Mr. Bostic and advising him that in his opinion they were frivolous, Thompson filed a motion pursuant to Swinney v. Leapley asking for the court's permission to withdraw. The circuit court, the Honorable Judge Serska, conducted two separate hearings in connection with Thompson's motion. The first was held on October 29, 1998, and was later continued at Bostic's request until November 19th of 1998 in order to allow him additional opportunity time within which to respond to Thompson's motion. An order was ultimately entered granting Thompson's motion to withdraw. The circuit court, based on its own independent review of the record, also entered an order dismissing the petition based on its finding that the issues raised therein were frivolous. A certificate of probable cause, however, was issued by Judge Serska, and Catherine Piplow was appointed to represent Bostic on appeal. Among the issues that Ms. Piplow raised in her brief was the alleged ineffective assistance on the part of Maggie Vandemore and not having better pursued what was argued to be a purported necessity defense. This court on October 30th, 2000 granted summary affirmance. Bostic filed his present petition for writ of habeas corpus in July of 2001, alleging that he was denied the opportunity to fully litigate whether Vandemore was ineffective due to Thompson's alleged ineffectiveness and asking the court for permission to withdraw. The circuit court Judge Keene, in a letter opinion dated March 4, 2002, rejected Bostic's argument that he was denied the opportunity to present claims regarding his medical history, the witnesses called, and the lack of an expert, and so on. According to Judge Keene, there were two transcripts full of Bostic's claims and assertions. In Judge Keene's view, and I quote, if it could have been brought up, Bostic raised the point. Judge Keene, therefore, dismissed the petition. The state would submit that Bostic's attempt to again relitigate the issue of whether Vandemore was ineffective is barred by the doctrine of res judicata. This court has, on several occasions, indicated that res judicata applies in habeas cases. That doctrine operates as a procedural bar not only as to those issues actually litigated, but also as to those which could have been raised. Bostic, however, argues this doctrine should not apply because he's never given the opportunity to litigate whether Vandemore was ineffective. According to Bostic, statute allows a, quote, re-raising of issues that were inadequately raised before. He is apparently referring to SDCL 21-27-16.1, which provides that a ground not raised or fully adjudicated in a prior habeas proceeding cannot serve as a basis for a subsequent application unless the circuit court specifically finds reasonable cause why those grounds were not inadequately raised in the first petition. Relying on this court's recent decision in Jackson, which found that ineffective assistance on the part of post-conviction counsel can constitute cause to excuse procedural default under the aforesaid statute, Bostic argues that based on Thompson's alleged ineffectiveness, he must now be allowed to raise his claim anew. In his brief, Bostic argues that Thompson is ineffective based on this court's finding in Krebs v. Weber, where this court found that a similar brief filed by Mr. Thompson failed to meet constitutional standards. The circuit court in this letter decision found that this case was far different than Krebs. According to Judge Keene, Judge Serska did not simply rubber stamp Mike Thompson's motion to withdraw. As noted by Judge Keene, Judge Serska held at least two hearings in connection with Thompson's motion and ruled against Bostic only after giving him an opportunity to be heard on the matter. The circuit court found there was simply no support whatsoever in the record to support Bostic's assertion that he was denied the opportunity to pursue his claims. In referring to the transcripts of the two hearings before Judge Serska, Judge Keene found that Bostic spent page after page in those hearings pointing to the trial transcripts and what he believed to be flaws in Vandemore's representation. In Judge Keene's view, Bostic's argument was premised on the erroneous notion that he was always entitled to a full evidentiary hearing. According to Judge Keene, however, the fact that Bostic was not given as expansive a hearing as he would have liked was not the proper criteria by which to judge Thompson's representation. As was aptly stated by Judge Keene, just because Bostic did not get what he asked for does not mean that his constitutional rights were violated. In Judge Keene's view, Where Bostic failed in his claim against Mike Thompson was that the issue of ineffective assistance had been previously raised. The problem in Judge Keene's view was that Bostic and the circuit court simply disagreed as to the ultimate conclusion.
How did Bostic get a full opportunity to raise any evidentiary issue he wanted before Sirska? Isn't that what this all comes down to?
Correct.
Did he get that?
The state believes he did. There were two separate hearings. Bostic had access to the contract attorney at the penitentiary. If you look at his presentation, it's pretty clear that he's knowledgeable in the law. He cited a great body of case law and statutory authority in support of his argument that defense counsel Ms. Vandenborg was ineffective.
If other witnesses needed to be interviewed, or if an expert needed to be retained, Bostic didn't have that ability, though, did he?
Well, Bostic complains that Maggie Vandenborg was ineffective for not having called witnesses who could have testified to his alleged heart condition. He hasn't presented any evidence as to what those witnesses would have testified to. Despite being afforded two separate hearings before Judge Keene, he failed to identify those witnesses and what they would have testified to. Now, although Bostic now attempts to criticize Mike Thompson for having failed to present any such evidence, it should be noted that current counsel also failed to do so when given the opportunity. The record reflects that a hearing...
I've got to interrupt you because I've been very curious about that. What opportunity was he given? I mean, this is before us on a motion to dismiss. You just suggested that Mr. Miller had the opportunity to present evidence.
Correct. The state had filed a procedural motion to dismiss.
Mr. Miller suggested in his argument that he didn't have that opportunity.
I believe if you look at the record speaks for itself. The hearing was initially scheduled before Judge Keene on December 19, 2001. Counsel wrote to the court specifically indicating that he was not prepared at that time to present any evidence regarding the reasonable cause issue. Reasonable cause equating with cause and prejudice. The circuit court, therefore, at Mr. Miller's request, rescheduled the hearing for February 7th. At the outset of that hearing, the circuit court, Judge Keene, specifically undertook to advise Bostic that, quote, since you're the moving party, you should probably proceed with the evidence. Bostic, however, simply responded, actually, I don't have any, Your Honor. He never made any attempt to establish how he was prejudiced as a result of defense counsel's alleged errors. Bostic instead argues that this court should find that the normal Strickland test does not apply in the present case and that prejudice should simply be presumed. The state will submit that Bostic has waived that argument. Bostic, if you look at the trial transcripts, in response to concerns expressed by Judge Keene regarding the, quote, merry-go-round to get on when you have successive claims and where does it end, specifically stated, you always have to point to a flaw in the fundamental trial. In other words, let's just say, for sake of argument, that Mr. Thompson and Ms. Peeble were ineffective in habeas number one. Let's just say that for sake of argument. That ineffectiveness makes no difference unless there is an error of substance in the first trial. As indicated by Mr. Bostic, Thompson's ineffectiveness is completely irrelevant unless it prevented a meritorious issue from having been raised in the first instance. Now, even if this court were to agree with Bostic, that there are certain cases where the adversarial process itself is so compromised that prejudice can be presumed, the state would submit that this is not one of those cases. Although relying heavily on this court's decision in Krebs to support his argument that post-conviction counsel Mike Thompson is ineffective, Bostic ignores that portion of the court's holding in Krebs, which found that a showing of prejudice was still required. Despite having found that the Andrew Sweeney brief submitted in that case failed to meet constitutional standards, this court refused to grant Krebs habeas relief. The court indicated that based on its review of the record, there was no prejudice or unfairness in the underlying trial. That holding is consistent with this court's recent decision in Jackson v. Weber, where this court again stated that ineffective assistance of counsel at a prior habeas proceeding alone is not enough for relief in a later habeas action. This court found that any new effort must be directed to an error in the original trial. The state would submit that it's obvious why Bostic is so reluctant to have this court address the prejudice prong of Strickland test, and that's because he can't establish any prejudice. Bostic has not shown that but for counsel's alleged errors, the outcome of his criminal trial would have been any different. His sole defense was one of medical necessity. This court has indicated that that's a limited defense, and the defendant must be stripped of all legal options by which to act. Here, the record reflects that Bostic never complained to jail staff regarding the medical care and medical treatment he's being afforded. In fact, when he was asked how he was feeling on the day of his escape, Bostic indicated only that he was tired, nothing else. There was no indication in the record that Bostic ever expressed any concern to staff regarding his safety while in jail. Now, in order to prevail on his incessant defense, Bostic also had to present evidence justifying his continued absence from custody. Bostic, however, made no attempt whatsoever to seek medical intervention during the 4 months that he was on escape status. That was a major factor relied on by the U.S. District Court in denying Bostic's request for federal habeas relief. In its memorandum decision dated April 27th, 2000, a copy of which is included in the appendix to the state's brief, the District Court found that despite Thompson's failure to provide what it characterized as vigorous representation, Bostic still failed to establish that he was denied his constitutional right to effective assistance of counsel. According to the District Court, there was no evidence that Bostic's heart condition required medication or treatment during the nearly 4 months before he was arrested and returned to custody. The court found that the jury was thus entitled to convict Bostic on the grounds that he failed to return to custody once the jail staff's alleged failure to treat his heart condition had lost its course of force. According to the District Court, it was very doubtful whether Bostic would have been acquitted even if Maggie Vandermore had presented additional testimony. Bostic, in his reply brief, concedes that his non-return was clearly a fact that the jury could be considered. The trial court, in this specific case, instructed the jury regarding the necessity defense. Under the instructions given, the defendant has raised the defense of necessity to discharge. The necessity defense to the crime of escape is met if the defendant at the time of the escape had a reasonable fear of death or imminent serious bodily harm if he remained in custody. Bostic's failure to seek medical attention at any point during the 4 months that he was on escape status clearly had a bearing on the reasonableness of his fears. Not only did Bostic fail to complain to medical staff regarding the treatment that he was provided, when he was specifically asked how he was feeling on the day in question, he indicated only that he was tired. Finally, he failed to make any attempt whatsoever to seek medical attention once he escaped from jail. With all due respect to counsel, the state would submit that it would be absurd to suggest that a rational trier of fact under the circumstances would have found that Bostic was justified in escaping from the Minnehaha County Jail.
You completed your presentation?
Yes, unless there are any further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Miller, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Mr. Miller, I'm going to take your invitation to ask questions early as well here. I forgot to ask you the first time, and I'm sure you're going to address it anyway because of the questions we just had. But you, in essence, have a two-step process now. You've got to show ineffective habeas counsel in order to be able to show ineffective trial counsel. Probably you'd agree with that proposition, wouldn't you?
For the most part. I guess okay. I have one quibble, but I'll talk about that later.
All right, well then tell me about the federal district court's decision that the habeas counsel won did not warrant relief. How should that affect our decision?
Okay. That'll take me 2 minutes, if you can give me 2 minutes to answer your question. If you're going to take judicial notice of the federal habeas decision, what I would encourage you to do is take judicial notice of the entire federal habeas file. And here's what you'll see. It was a pro se motion filed by Mr. Bostic. Of course, in the federal system, no counsel was provided to him. His motion for counsel was denied. And then when you read, and so no evidence was ever developed. It was, here's the application. There's a whole bunch of pro se motions in there. But no evidence is developed except the actual record. And when you read Judge Pearsall's decision, and this is true under federal habeas practice, Judge Pearsall assumed that Judge Cirska's rejection of the claim was one on the merits. And under federal practice, a state court finding on the merits is entitled to a presumption of correctness. In other words, from my perspective, federal habeas rarely exists anymore for prisoners because of that presumption of correctness. And so that's the first basis for Judge Pearsall's opinion, is that he credits Judge Sirska's decision. And under federal law, he can't overturn it unless the evidence conclusively shows that it's wrong. And then second, Judge Pearsall adopts the federal criminal rule regarding the defense of justification for escape. And this is what I cover in my brief. I didn't cover the first part of my brief, which is different than South Dakota laws. Judge Pearsall relies upon a U.S. Supreme Court decision as binding, which it is under federal criminal practice, which this court has rejected as the law in South Dakota in State versus Miller. And so Judge Pearsall felt himself constrained to agree with Judge Sirska, if at all possible. And he was giving presumptive effect to Judge Sirska's decision. And now, to accept the state's argument, here's what I am asked to believe. I'm asked to believe that even if you assume that Judge Sirska's decision shouldn't be followed as a matter of state law, that Mr. Bostic should get at least one fair opportunity to litigate his claim in state court. You can't rule that way because you are giving essentially res judicata effect to Judge Pearsall's decision. A great deal of why he ruled the way he did was because he gave res judicata effect, in essence. I know I'm using that word wrong, but you all understand where I'm coming from. He gave res judicata effect to Judge Sirska's decision. And so you would put yourself in a position of saying, you know, we don't agree with the way things are handled before Judge Sirska, and if were it up to us, we'd give him a fair right to a hearing, but we can't do that because another judge in a different system of justice, using a standard of substantive law which we have already rejected, has given preclusive effect to Judge Sirska's ruling. And, you know, please be careful how you write that, if that's the way you're going to rely on that, because I don't see the logic in that. It's a house of cards. If Judge Sirska's ruling was wrong, and if you think it was flawed, the fact that it was erroneously relied upon by a different judicial system shouldn't affect your decision one way or the other. And so I guess I don't know the answer to the question of whether you can take judicial notice of Judge Pearsall's decision, but if you can, please take judicial notice of the entire file. And I guess that would be my 4-minute answer to your question. The other thing I would like to address, if I could, is, you know, no one here has really talked about, and I don't plan to now, no one here has really talked about the deficient performance prong of the ineffective counsel test regarding Mr. Thompson. We're all instead focusing on the prejudice prong. And we would be in a different procedural situation if, before Judge Keene, here's what had happened. If Judge Keene had said, you know, we have to talk about prejudice here, and I need you to show me, Mr. Miller, I need you to show me what it is about Maggie Vandemore's representation and what should have been done that would have changed the outcome of the trial. And then I would know, and I would be on notice if that's what I have to produce. And then I could have argued whatever I would have argued regarding automatic prejudice if had that come up. And then we would have a record, so we would know why Judge Keene ruled the way he did. But that never came up at the hearing, and I can understand why, because the amended petition which raised Mr. Thompson's ineffectiveness wasn't filed until, I believe, the day before the hearing, at most 2 days before the hearing. So that's why it never came up. And Judge Keene never relied on that in his decision. And so when the state argues that I had to show that prejudice, even though it never came up at the hearing, what really is happening here is that is an ex post facto way to justify a decision when that was never an issue at the hearing before Judge Keene.
Would it have been different if Judge Keene would have said he's going to treat it as a motion for summary judgment as opposed to a Rule 12 motion?
I think it would have been different. At that point, he would have had to give me the opportunity to present additional evidence, I'm sure. At least that's my understanding of the civil rule. If you transform a motion to dismiss into summary judgment, you have to give notice and opportunity to be heard. And
What about the state's suggestion that you were given an opportunity to present evidence?
Well, certainly had I had it there, I could have presented it, but it never came up. And to tell you the truth, had it come up, I would have asked for a continuance of the hearing so that I could have gotten it. I walked in there thinking I was facing a legal question on a motion to dismiss, and that's very clear when you read the first three pages of that transcript. I say we're here for procedural reasons only. That's why I don't have any other evidence. And so I wasn't ready to present evidence there, but I would have asked for a continuance. I wouldn't have, you know, if I had been told by the judge I need to hear evidence or else, I wouldn't have said I have none. That would be suicide. I wouldn't have done that. I would have asked for a fair opportunity to present it. But I still maintain, even though we haven't talked about it much, that this is a case so egregious that automatic prejudice results. I know that happens very infrequently. I know that rule isn't applied very often. But I can't see one thing at all in the way Mr. Thompson represented Mr. Bostic that shows that he received the assistance of counsel. And it's the assistance of counsel that the Sixth Amendment guarantees. So I question whether I have to, and of course, if I succeed with this court in obtaining a ruling that Mr. Thompson was ineffective, therefore the Judge Sirska proceedings are just erased, and therefore we start over from scratch, I am not winning Mr. Bostic's release. All I am winning is his right to litigate his claim. Strong, weak, indifferent. His right to litigate his claim. That's all he's up here at this procedural juncture. That's all he's up here asking for. Now, the court may wish to re-examine its decision, its substantive decision on escape and the defense of justification in Miller. And, you know, you're free to do that, although I question whether that would apply retroactively to Mr. Bostic's case. But I guess that's all I have, unless you have other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Miller.
Thank you. Invite me back.
We probably will. Court will be in recess until 10 o'clock.